Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to Sundays with the Modern. This is a program that offers unique perspectives on the museum's architecture, permanent collection, and special exhibitions from a variety of voices. For example, last week we had artist Stephen Leptisophon here. He did a wonderful job. Next week we have contemporary art historian and art writer Dr. Francis Colpit here. And this week we have the unique perspective of history professor, historian Dr. Todd Kurtstetter. Each of these individuals have chosen to focus on what has been a very popular special exhibition, Ed Ruscha Road Tested, an exhibition curated by the Modern's chief curator, Michael Opping, and available exclusively to this museum's audience. So congratulations for being here today, and hopefully you'll get to visit the exhibition again. It's an exhibition that obviously offers an enormous range of material, given that each of these Sunday tours have been incredibly varied, each providing new insights in their own way. Today is no exception. Todd's background and interests bring a fresh take on the subject of this exhibition. With a BA in poli-sci from Duke, an MA from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and a PhD in the fields of U.S. history, American West, Native Americans, and environmental history from...
Nebraska.
I'm sorry, I failed to write that one down. Todd is Associate Professor of History at TCU and Director of Graduate Studies in that department. His monograph, God's Country, Uncle Sam's Land, Faith and Conflict in the American West, was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2006 and more recently has come out in paperback. In addition, he has written numerous articles for publications including Western Historical Quarterly and American Journalism, and many, many encyclopedia entries on topics from Branch Davidians and Alcatraz occupation to Native American movement and the National Congress of American Indians. It is with all of this, as well as Todd's interest and research done in the area of popular culture and the American West, that's going to inform today's tour. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Todd Kurtstetter.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you to all of you for being inside on a lovely Sunday afternoon in springtime. And thanks to the Modern for asking me to come talk today. This is a first for me, giving a talk at this museum. I'm a little more of a regular up the hill where they have more Western art. And I was really excited to get this invitation and a little bit nervous because I don't know a lot about modern art. I know even less about Ed Ruscha, and I've gotten a real education in this. But the most exciting part for me was when I came to scout the exhibition for the first time and walked in very nervous about what am I going to do with this gas station stuff. And I found a friend had muscled its way off the wall, up the hill, and come down here to save me. And of course, that's not entirely true. I don't think this has ever been up the hill at the Amon Carter, but when I saw a wagon train, I knew I'd be able to do something with this. And this image provides me the foundation for most of what I'm going to do today, even though it's unlike most of the other stuff in here. Almost everything else that I can think of, and I didn't really carefully take note of this, but I don't think there's anything else in here that really depicts anything that is not 20th century. I think this is the only thing that might be taken as a 19th century depiction of the American West. And still, it's in here for a reason. And one of the things that I really like anymore about art museums, having spent some time in them now, is going into an exhibit and trying to figure out what was in the mind of the people who organized the thing. What was the curator thinking? If the curator worked in concert with the artist, what were they thinking as a group? And I've, in the several visits that I've made to come out here and prepare for this, have taken to labeling the galleries in my own mind with my own names, and this one I'm calling Uncertainty. And it comes from the title of this image, which is uncertain frontier. And I found this thing to be very much an inverse image of what I'd encountered in most of the 19th century depictions of similar things that I've seen. And the images that really came to mind as I thought about this were things like George Caleb Bingham's Daniel Boone leading settlers through the Cumberland Gap, and John Gast's American Progress, and Fanny Palmer's Westward the Course of Empire Takes Its Path. And in case you don't know any of those, let me tell you about why I think this is an inverse and why I think this begins to lend an interesting perspective on the 20th century and on the West. And most of those images that I just described, the lighting is almost exactly opposite of how I interpret this one. This one, it looks to me like there's this wagon train of people, I assume, heading west to an uncertain frontier. And they are presumably coming from a point of civilization and order and a place that has been tamed and heading off into the wild frontier to settle the West, conquer the West, deal with the frontier. All those other images that I mentioned to you typically have on these people, as representatives of civilization, the light shining on them. And the darkness is off in the wilderness, in the future, in the place that is to be encountered and tamed. And this I found very interesting in that the dark seems to be on the people who are supposedly in those other narratives through images going off to tame, conquer, and civilize the frontier. It's also interesting, I think, and this I realized applies to most of this room, that there's an awful lot of blurriness in here. It's very black and white, very hazy, unclear images. And that's unusual compared to those other images that I mentioned to you, which are very crisp and sharp, and I'm sure there's plenty of stylistic reasons for that. But what this suggests to me is, in the present, as it's depicted in this image, there's some uncertainty and some blurriness and some darkness. And while the future or the frontier is uncertain, according to the title, that's where the light is, that's where the hope is, that's where these people are going and presumably hoping to do something. So even though it's inverted from what I'm normally accustomed to seeing in this kind of an image about the West and westering, it led me to think that there's some hope in here and that it's an optimistic image. Part of the way I'd like to tie all this stuff together also into my thinking about the American West, or at least how I've been doing it, you can argue with me about this as we go along, see if you buy any of this stuff, is that I see this almost as a revisionist history of the story of Western expansion. That there's the uncertainty now, there's perhaps a bright future, but we don't know. I would argue that every one of those images I mentioned to you, the John Gast, the Bingham, the Fanny Palmer, have a very certain, clear image of what they expect to happen. These people are going to go out there, they're going to tame the frontier, they're going to bring civilization with them. This one is uncertain. It says, I mean, we don't know. It's hopeful, but we don't know what's going to happen. And I found it interesting that this image, which Ruscha made in 1987, coincided almost exactly with a big historical debate among my people, the so-called Old Western historians and New Western historians. And the New Western historians were accused of being revisionist and casting aspersions on the classic tale of westward expansion as being a triumphal narrative and march of civilization across the continent. And then these New Western historians pointed out, well, should we talk about the dispossession of Native Americans? Should we talk about the war with Mexico and the dispossession of Hispanics in the West? Should we talk about, on and on and on, sort of the real picture? And one of my favorite of these New Western historians is a guy named Elliot West, who described this so-called New Western history as a longer, grimmer, more interesting story, rather than that nice, neat, tied-up bundle of progress across the continent. And I think this is almost a visual representation of that. Whether Ruscha had that in mind, who knows? But that's how this struck me. And then, as I expanded to the rest of this room, it dawned on me, I think on my third visit to the exhibit, that boy, everything in this room is kind of fuzzy. And almost everything in here is produced relatively recently in Ruscha's career. I think this might be the earliest piece in here. It's mostly from 87 until 2009. And there's an awful lot of haziness and fuzziness in these images. And I wondered if that was a conscious decision on the part of the people who put the exhibit together. I had so much I wanted to say about this. I don't want to go too long because we got other stuff to look at. My mind and my eye wandered around the room from this one, and we're pretty well located here for this, I guess. This one I didn't really think about much in these terms until today, in terms of what's this say about the West. And the fuzziness then it sort of dawned on me that with much of what is written about and thought about in terms of the West in history and popular culture, it's stuff that's sort of rural. And yet one of the striking trends that's gone on in the 20th century, demographically speaking, in the West, is that the rural West is really being depopulated. There are huge chunks of Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, the Dakotas, that are losing population as young people come of age and look for opportunity, and they don't find much in rural America and are increasingly heading to cities. And I have no idea what Ruscha meant when he put this thing together, but it struck me as there's sort of cloudiness and haziness in this one. Maybe this could be a way to think about what's going on in rural America. And before I forget, one other theme I wanted to mention in here is that it seems like there's so much concern and interest in the 19th century West. And when I teach courses on it, I think my students, whenever they hear about a course on the West, they're thinking cowboys and Indians, settlers, gold rush, and things like that, for very good reason. But I also teach a course strictly on the 20th century West. And one of the points that came up in the debate between the New Western historians and the Old Western historians is that there's very much still a continuation of themes important to Western history into the 20th century. And for me, this exhibit points out that there's very important stuff going on in the 20th century West. Maybe first and foremost, Ruscha, being born in Omaha, raised in Oklahoma, and then moving to Los Angeles, where he has become an influential member of the art community, that fits in with some of the interpretations that have been done about the significance of the West in the 20th century as it has transitioned from almost a colony of the East to a self-sufficient, very important, creative engine for the economy and culture and things like that. So Ruscha, being a Westerner, at least by my definition, by birth and upbringing, and then working and producing in the West and having his influence radiate out from Los Angeles, I think fits into all of this. And then I kept finding more. As I got down to this one, this silhouette of an oil derrick, which I think is interesting in how it's presented. It is, from the viewer's perspective, on a pedestal almost. And we're looking up at this, and that to me suggests in a way the importance of petroleum to us in the 20th century. It also demonstrates to me some ties to the traditional conceptions of the West being based on extractive economies, whether they be mining or farming or lumbering or petroleum. And I'm pretty sure the organizers didn't have any of that stuff in mind when they chose this particular image. I think it fits in much more nicely with their road-tested theme and the notion that we want to show or organize a set of works that Ruscha did based on what you might see out the window of a car. But I think it's critical that you can't appreciate and understand driving around in a car and experiencing the United States, the West, any place without this thing, which provides the fuel for the car and for a big chunk of the 20th century and in big chunks of the West, fueled the economy as well. And then these other things I'm not quite sure what to do with. But the imagery of this one struck me as being a very nice counterpoint to the one catty corner from it on the far side. If I remember right, the title of that image is Standard. And that is a shadow, a reworking of some of the more well-known Ruscha works that we're going to encounter as we move into another gallery. But sort of the geometry of the thing struck me as being similar. Maybe there's some echoes in the geometry, and maybe that linked these things. And certainly this would to me, symbolically be the fuel in its raw form coming up out of the ground. And somewhere between this corner of the room and that corner of the room, it gets processed, put back in the ground, and then when automobilists come up to fill their cars up, it comes up out of the ground again in the refined form and fuels their journeys wherever they're going. I believe that's all I wanted to talk about in here. But before we go, would any of you like to make comments or ask questions about any of the stuff that I've happened to talk about or any of your own observations about any of these works? Yes, ma'am.
What about the religious and mythical works that we've been playing with in movies and things like this?
The question is, what about images of the mythical West we've been familiar with in movies and so on? And I think I have two responses to that. And could you be more specific? Let me ask for a refining of that. I think there is a contrast between the mythic images and what was produced later in the 20th century. That, I think, is maybe one of the classic mythical images. And in a way, your question precedes what's going to happen in Gallery 2. If I don't come back to that, please prod me to do that. And part of what I wonder about, and maybe this is a nice way to transition into that next gallery, the stuff in here seems sort of fuzzy, and I wonder if that's not in some ways a sense of the artist's maturation and ways of thinking about things, that all these images were produced in the 80s or after, with the exception of those photographs on the wall. I don't remember what those are. But I wonder if that's not in some ways a reflection of things getting more complicated in his mind. And when we walk into the next gallery, this one I call uncertainty. That next one, I had another name for it, but I'll call it certainty. And just in terms of looking at the shapes, the images, the coloring, it's really a big difference. And all the images, most of the ones in there that I'm going to talk about, were produced in the 60s, and I think are very much reflective of a different time. How much of this always puzzles me about talking about art. How much of this was in the guy's mind when he made this stuff, I don't know. But this is all 80s and after. That next room is mostly in the 60s, and having primed your intellectual pumps that way, I won't say anything for a minute until we get in there and you can look at that and say, well, what's the difference? The first title I came up with in my mind for that next gallery is Standard. But I would say you could also play it off this one. If this one is uncertainty, that one I think is certainty. And furthermore, I've got another little bit to do with the Mythic West and these images in that next gallery. So if I don't do that, don't let us leave without coming back to it. So let's move over to the... Oh, I'm sorry, one more question. I like that very much. And I think I agree with that. I think it was one of the things I probably had left out. And I think it's also going to play off what happens when we go into that next room. I couldn't tell if somebody was going to make a comment there or not. But I think sunset is maybe a nice thing. Maybe this is a suggestion or a hint at peak oil having been hit and the negative consequences of all the driving that we do. And the sunset of that Standard station, I'm not sure where to go with that, but I think you're onto something, and let's see if we can jointly come up with something by the end of the walkthrough. Very nice. Speaking of the next room, let's shift galleries and go in this one and just a hair around to the right side. In some ways, both. And let's start off with that one because that might be a question other people are interested in. While we were walking, an audience member asked about the Old West and New West. Do those terms refer to new and old histories or new and old time periods? And I think in many ways they do both. The Old West history tends to focus more on the 19th century and has a breaking point, usually about 1890. There's one particular historian who says the frontier ended that time, and that really marks a watershed in terms of our national development and our national history. So there's this fascination, especially with the 19th century. I think the new Western historians, in addition to representing a new school of history, are also much more likely to focus on events after 1890. So very good question, and thank you. This painting and I are the same age. I think it's holding up better than I am. Moving into this room, and I ask you to think about lines and certainty and uncertainty. Have any of you been struck by any lightning bolts since you walked in here? They're sharp edges, really clean lines, bright, bright colors. And part of where I've gone in my own mind thinking about this is that Ruscha did these pieces in the 60s. He had a lot of training as a graphic artist before he went to art school. And I wonder, and here again, I wonder if I'm not reading too much into it, but let's see where this goes. He was younger, more idealistic. The United States had not, Vietnam was just sort of coming out of its shell as what it would turn into be. I think this is maybe a more affluent time in some ways. The years from 1945 until 1960 were remarkably prosperous for great segments of the American population. And having vanquished the Axis powers in World War II, I think there was, to a certain extent, some optimism in the United States and Americans that maybe is being represented in the crisp certainty and colors of these images. I'm not sure. One of the reasons I got really interested in this as I started to sink my teeth into it is that, sort of like Ruscha did, he had a couple seminal road trips in his life. One was by automobile to go off to art school in L.A. He also did some hitchhiking when he was 14, which I thought was astonishing. My mom certainly would not have let me do that. She wouldn't like it if I did it now. When I was 25, I quit my job, and a buddy and I bicycled from Myrtle Beach, North Carolina, to Vancouver, British Columbia, mostly on what William Least Heat Moon would call blue highways. One, because we were prohibited from going on the interstate system on bicycles, and secondly, because it was just easier and better and more interesting to go that way. And these images really resonated with me, because when we would go on stretches of road, and there's one in Wyoming in particular that I think was 73 miles with no service or water or anything, and we were very nervous that morning as we set off, and we were so happy to see something like this on the horizon. So I'm very keen on roadside imagery. And also, I think an important part of American history, and I don't know if the West is any distinct in this, but transportation is so important. When Lyndon Johnson signed the legislation in 1966, creating the Department of Transportation, he said, I'm going to be close on this, maybe not exact, the history of our nation is to a large degree the history of our transportation. And these images being produced in the early 60s, and then some of them being reproduced later, I think capture a moment in that transportation and play off this word standard as well. And where I went with this in my mind is that in the course of automobile travel in the United States, going back to the teens, the first transcontinental motor highway was the Lincoln Highway, which was started, I think, roughly around 1913 or so. And the people who traveled that as they went across the nation and went to different places followed a road that had been laid out pretty much on the landscape. So it, in many places, followed the landscape. And as somebody traveled from place to place, would typically get a lot of local flavor as they traveled. When Route 66 became the first of a new generation of transcontinental highways, it was a little bit more imposing. It was a little bit more standard, a little bit more thought out in its design. But it still had an awful lot of local flavor as you traveled from place to place to place. If you fast forward into the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and up to the present, once the interstate highway system was in place, and that legislation was passed in 56, I think, those roads, unlike the Lincoln Highway or unlike Route 66, imposed themselves on the landscape. Those things were planned nationally very carefully. I've looked at plans where they talk about the road grade is going to be this, the roads are going to be so wide, you can't have an incline any bit steeper than this, you can't have any turns any steeper than that. The rest areas are kind of mapped out and standardized. And with the interstate highways coming roughly coincidentally with the rise of national chains in restaurants, lodging, and gas stations, I would argue that that experience of traveling by road became much more standardized. And I think this is what Roucher saw in these images. I don't know, again, if that's exactly what he was trying to project, but I think these things represent a time where the travel experience was becoming more standardized. I think they're also significant in terms of how they represent roadside architecture, or roadscapes is a term I like to think about. And getting back to standardization, one, there's that experience of travel in the road. Secondly, there was a pretty significant standardization in terms of architecture and design, specifically with respect to gas stations. Using the Texaco Corporation as an example, and it's just one that I happen to be able to find some information on, they, up until the 1930s, had about a dozen different styles of station that they built, and they were very regionally flavored. The Texaco stations in the Southwest sometimes had a mission-style architecture to them. Texaco stations in the Northeast sometimes looked like a colonial cottage, so there was this regional reflection. In 1937, they set an architect to creating a cleaner, more standard look for Texaco stations. And this guy, I had his name on the tip of my tongue not too long ago, I apologize for forgetting it, but produced a blueprint in 1937 that became the standard design for Texaco stations. And from 1937 until 1964, Texaco licensed 10,000 of these things to be built across the country, and they were sort of QB, white enamel, racing stripes on them, and they were designed in response to market research that said people are much more likely to stop at a gas station if it looks clean and nice, which is still the case, especially at least when I travel with my wife. She'd say, no, we're not going there. We're going to go to that one. So it was very important, and the design was in response to that. And also, this architect supposedly wanted to project some of the image and sleekness and speed of the machine age. And another consideration, not only to project cleanliness and speed, was ease of recognition. People were traveling in automobiles fairly quickly. It was nice for them to be able to spot from a distance, there's the place, I like Texaco, I have a credit card there, whatever, and let's go there. So in that sense, there's a reflection in the architecture of how life was changing. And this thing, I think, represents that. This one is from 1963. Very clean lines. Looks, I would go use their bathroom. I think I could convince my wife to use their bathroom. Looks nice, clean, speedy, and so on. And it's also very much saying in the title, standard. Maybe that reflects something of the standardization of travel. This is one of the places on my bicycle trip I would have just been thrilled to see. And especially, this one is depicted representing a station in Amarillo, Texas. I think the way these roadside buildings present themselves is different in the West. On the Great Plains in particular, and this was certainly my case or my experience when I was doing that bicycle ride, you're coming across this big flat space. You can see something from far away, and these things literally do loom up out of the ground like this. They're very imposing structures. And I had another experience. Not only did I go to school in Nebraska, I lived for a year in Kearney, Nebraska. And I would travel to Lincoln, which is 120 miles exactly down the highway, not that I was counting. And as I would come back sometimes from a weekend in Lincoln to go back to Kearney, which is in some ways in the middle of nowhere, you could see Kearney by the glow well before you could see any of the buildings. And that, again, reminded me of this. And I'm not sure what he was up to with these yellow beams of light, but it reminds me very much of searchlights, maybe at a film premiere, and maybe this was the opening of the station. I don't know. Maybe it's something that's thrown in there as a bit of pizzazz to say, well, here's sort of the coming future. Here's the star of the landscape. I just don't know. But I thought this is very interesting in how it resonated with me in terms of how in the West, especially on the plains, something like this can really loom up out of the landscape and be very striking. So far, so good. I'd like to talk about this next image, so please relocate yourself where you can get a good glimpse of it. Unlike that image, which identifies the station as existing in Amarillo, Texas, this one doesn't give us any clue about where it is, at least in the title. It looks to me like it's probably the exact same station, but I don't know if it's meant to be or not. What grabbed me in this one, and where's the person who asked about the Mythic West? Here's the one that I wanted to get to. This image, in addition to the station, has up in the top right corner a 10-cent Western being torn in half. And here, this is one of the images I got really excited about in this collection because it, to me, makes a very vivid statement about something going on with the West and with standardization. And in the catalog for this exhibit, I think is where I read this, the people who wrote the analysis speculate about this thing in the title says popular Western, and the station is labeled standard, and maybe this is a riff on when something becomes popular, it often becomes standard. And I like that. I also took this in a different direction as I thought about it. And as that roadside experience that I mentioned became more and more standardized, I interpret that as losing a little bit of regional flair, where if you're going down Route 66 and you're somewhere in Oklahoma and you see a hotel that's shaped like a bunch of teepees, you sort of feel like you're going someplace new and different, and you've left home and gone someplace new and interesting. This thing could be anywhere. If we follow that example I gave of the Texaco stations licensing 10,000 stations to be built across the country based on that set of blueprints, you don't have that sense of local flavor. So my take on this thing is maybe there's something to this standardization of American culture that is suggesting some decline in regionalism, and maybe that standardization is partly responsible for ending or tearing up something unique about the Western. However many of you there are, I bet we could go in 25, 30 different directions with an interpretation. But that violence being done to that dime novel suggests something other than it suggests to me a tension between the two rather than some kind of resonance. And I'd go back to my New West and Old West historians again. I think that in some ways, this depiction of the 20th century, as our culture becomes more standard across the country, we lose some of that regional flavor, and you come into the 20th century with the West, and does that West still exist anymore? I don't have an answer. But we've got another gallery or two to look at, and before we move, I invite questions or comments. Yes, sir. Sure.
And you have the sites on the side of the nest where they artists go, they set up these canvas and they take a picture of this distance. So here we have all the gas stations you can see, and you went, down the highway. Okay, you have so much to be wild.
Very much so. Sure. And not only monumental, and this is in a way a random thought that came to my mind, I happened to catch the artist on the TV show Iconoclasts, where he was teamed up with Stella McCartney, who's Paul McCartney's daughter and a fashion designer. And in the course of talking about his images, she pointed out something about the shape of a number of them. And apparently this this thing is very common, not only in the standard stations, but in some of his other images. And he talked about, I can't remember exactly how clear he was, but he said he had this image in his mind of old movies where there's a train that comes across the horizon and you get that Doppler effect of the sound, and he sort of sees this as a very vivid depiction of motion going from side to side. Speaking of motion, let's go into the next gallery. I'm going to speak briefly about one piece in this room, and it's the one right behind me, and I should probably get out of the way of it. And I got to admit, actually I don't got to, I will admit, I had a little bit more trouble coming up with stuff the further I got into this exhibit. The stuff that resonated with me most was what's in the first two rooms. But this one struck me very powerfully. The image's title is Cities in Question. And one, on first glimpse, to me, it looked like a sunset or a sunrise, I'm not sure. And then I had to get up close to see what the writing was on it, and there are a number of cities, most of them in the West. Miami, New York City, not, Chicago, Dallas, Tulsa, Wichita, Denver, and L.A. So I'm not exactly sure what kind of Western significance there is there. I also noticed down here, it looks like a couple people. I'm seeing a father and a son, or a mother and a daughter, adult and a child sitting there looking at this maybe night sky and seeing the cities maybe as stars. I'm not sure what to do with that. But what it did make me think about was a way in which the West is sometimes not considered, that's very important to its existence and its history, and that is its cities are really important. And again, where's the Mythic West person? She's still with us. There you are. I think the mythic conception of the West is the rural one. Farmers, cowboys, cattle drives, pioneers, not so much cities. And for a long, long time, cities have been really critical to the West, and the West, for a long time, has been one of the most, if not the most, urban section of the country. You don't think of it that way because there's all this open space where there aren't cities, but there also typically aren't very many people. But in terms of measuring where most of the people live, the West has been predominantly urban for quite a time. So cities were very important. They were sometimes one of the first places created when people moved someplace new and there was a population that could support them, and they were absolutely critical in terms of providing services, law enforcement, jobs, you know, economic development. And in particular, I don't want to make too much of this in this image, but Los Angeles on here in the West Coast, I think, is where, as the West has matured as a region in the 20th century, that's been really where the economic engine has been driving the region, and where you've got Los Angeles developing into a significant art and cultural center. The film industry's been there for an awful long time. The recording industry's there. That's something I've been working with in my own research recently. And speaking of which, not only Los Angeles, if I could put a question mark up here next to the name of Seattle, thinking back into the 90s when the grunge music movement was important, and there was not only the music movement, there was sort of a grunge fashion thing that was a cultural development that came out of the West and influenced the rest of the country. And I think symbolized in a lot of ways how the West was maturing, and to the extent you buy that it was ever a colony of the East, has shifted in power, and ideas are now being generated in the West and sent elsewhere. What the rest of these cities in question have in mind, I don't know. The pace picks up here. Any questions or comments before we abandon this gallery? Let's try the next one. I'd like to work with these. This one very briefly. Not sure where this is going, but I walked in and saw this thing, and the day before I had come on this particular visit where this thing struck me, I'd been listening to Lyle Lovett's L.A. County, which has lyrics. I'm awful with lyrics. The lights of L.A. County shine like diamonds in the sky, and it was, okay. So this is 87 before Lovett wrote that song. It's got nothing to do with it. That's sort of a random observation, but these really caught my attention. I think for a little meatier reasons. And I just mentioned in there the significance of the West, especially California and Southern California, as a cultural engine, creator of culture with the film industry, the recording industry, and so on. And I think this representation of the Hollywood sign gets at that importance. And this is the one that struck me the first time I came through the exhibit, and it continues to strike me every time I come through. Because to me, it is such the antithesis of how that mythic Hollywood, you're going to regret that question, how the mythic Hollywood is typically portrayed, or the stereotypical Hollywood, that it's stars, glamour, and so on. And this thing, I've never seen that sign placed in that perspective. It always seems to be sort of up on the hill. And with something behind it, I've never seen where the letters are really cast in silhouette. And with nothing around it, makes me think of a sort of post-apocalyptic landscape. And what's going on with this? And I keep coming back to my New Western historians and the longer, grimmer, more interesting story they tell about the West, that certainly there is that Hollywood that is the dream machine and the creator of all this wonderful entertainment, but there's also a very seedy side to it, and a lot of broken dreams or dreams that never materialize. And to me, that part of the story is reflected in this image. Maybe it's just Knight. I don't know what he was up to when he made the image, but it got me thinking about the different incarnations of how you tell a story about someplace like Hollywood. And scratch that. There was something else I was going to mention about this. Please buy me some time to think.
What role is there humor in what he's doing? Is he kind of poking fun at it? Because that's my neighborhood. I grew up in that.
Oh, really?
Probably.
And that's, for me, really difficult to discern. Especially, I don't know if it's because it's in an art museum. This guy, in the interview he did on Iconoclasts, he did talk, and Stella McCartney talked about what a great sense of humor he had and how some of this is tongue-in-cheek. So I'm virtually certain it's in there. But coming in here and looking at these things being presented in a museum, I was like, I've got to take this seriously first. And that's sort of my default approach to it. But I think there is. I think there's a lot of humor in some of these things, and it's probably maybe satirical or humorous or whatever else. And part of what I think is interesting, you bring up these apartments. And I think that's what these are. What struck me about those is in most of those cases, it's very standard architecture. Just boxy apartment buildings that are perhaps the apartment building equivalent of those standard gas stations a couple galleries back, and yet to try to zazz them up a little bit, they've got these cool names on them, like the Twin Palms or the Oasis, or I can't remember the names, but they get their regionalism, and a number of them are named for something regional. They get their individual identity stamped on them by the name rather than by the architecture, and I bet there's humor in all of these things. And watching him on the TV show, he did seem like a pretty he's got a well-developed sense of humor, but it's also, at least in that interview, very kind of dry. And, and you wonder when he's flexing it and when he's not. It came to me. The other thing that this image inspired in my thought process, or linked to, partly because I've been working with songs recently, especially songs that have been written about the West since 1980, there's a song by the Red Hot Chili Peppers called Californication. And there's also a TV show by that name. And the term has been around since, I don't know, I traced it back at least to, I think, 1972 in a Time or Newsweek article. And it refers to the notion of sort of dripping down or dumbing down or changing culture in a way that's not very good, and having come out of California. And I wonder if there's not some of that. Maybe this is part of the humor of it, that the stuff that radiates out of Hollywood can be very good. It can also be, and according to the lyrics of this Red Hot Chili Peppers song, it talks about Hollywood selling things. Hollywood sells this, Hollywood sells that, Hollywood sells Californication. And obviously there's nothing directly linking that, but it's one of the thoughts that popped into my mind about how there's both good and bad that come out of whatever the culture is being generated, movies, songs, art, I suppose. And maybe this dark side of the Hollywood image is related to that. Yes, ma'am. I would buy that in a heartbeat. And in particular, let me spin off here into this piece that I'm working on music. I talk pretty significantly about Nirvana, or at some length, and Nirvana is one of the biggest, best-known bands of the grunge movement. And their big breakthrough album was called Nevermind, and the huge success that followed is one of the things that I think drove the lead singer to distraction. He eventually killed himself. And one of the things he complained about was that this breakthrough album that they made, while he wanted to make it sort of a punk-sounding album, they went and did it, recorded it, and engineered it in L.A. with an engineer who had worked with a lot of commercial bands, and he was disillusioned that this thing that he wanted or had hoped would be more of a punk album came out sounding like a Motley Crue album, which is sort of a mainstream popular heavy metal band, and that was some of the tension that went on in there. And to me, that strikes me as this Kurt Cobain fellow saying, taking his music down to L.A., got it californicated into this thing, and even though it was a huge success and turned their careers around, it seemed like it created a lot of tension within him and the band. So I put a lot of stock in that observation. Let's do... Oh, sorry.
The comment about satirism and Rich's word made me think about this one again, where it has this sort of romantic view of Los Angeles, but it has tough radio written over it. Not exactly the most romantic entertainment for them, yet it's something...
Sure. And I think fits into some of the standardization themes.
Very low quality, and they are, maybe that's not the right way to say it, but not exactly a format given to craftsmanship and originality. It's kind of something that's just thrown out there.
I like it. Pardon me. As far as I know, off the top of my head, I would say yes.
Yeah.
Sure. And then taking what had been a very individualistic, local, artsy type thing and stamping it with a corporate identity and completely standardizing it. Sure. I'm not sure where to conclude in here, and I promise you with the last one, your attention span has done very well so far. Mine usually clocks out right at 45 minutes. The two images in here that interested me most were a boulevard called Sunset, and this other one is called Hollywood and Topeka. And this one, again, hit me because Sunset Boulevard's got so many mythic connotations. There's a film by this name, and to me, anyway, somebody who grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, Sunset Boulevard, California, Hollywood, very glamorous place, and it's not depicted here glamorously at all. Very smoggy, or cloudy or sort of blurred and dimly lit. So that again to me called into mind some of the longer, grimmer, more interesting stories about the West. And then this last one, which I really don't know what to do with. And it's one of the reasons I'm fascinated with it, and I'll leave it here because maybe you can help me solve this before we all go. This one's called Hollywood to Pico. And there are street names successively leading down the way. It's Hollywood Boulevard, Sunset Boulevard, Santa Monica Boulevard, Melrose, Beverly, Third, Wilshire, Olympic, and Pico. And I'm convinced there's something really important going on here. I still haven't quite put my finger on what it is. I had to get out a map of LA to try to figure out where this is oriented. And these streets and the perspective on them is from roughly Hollywood and Hollywood Boulevard, looking almost due south. These streets run east-west and then recede away. And maybe it's going from the center of Hollywood, which is, if I remember from the map at the beginning of the exhibit properly, that's where Ruscha's studio is, sort of in this neighborhood, looking that way. My first hunch when I saw it was maybe these things were moving west into the ocean. But no, they aren't. And they're all, most of them are street names I've recognized and know and are sort of iconic. And very good. I hadn't put all that together, so I thank you. This is good. I need more clues. Yes, ma'am. That isn't the upside downness of it. I hadn't considered. I think that's important. Okay. Okay. He said it's in descending order of awareness, or that's not the word you use, but notoriety, fame. There's a very gritty texture to it, which I think is maybe some reference to the reality of life in Hollywood not being as glamorous as it is sometimes depicted. I feel a little bit better and more informed about this image. I'm going to keep wrestling with it. And I'm going to wrap things up on that note and let you all keep wrestling with it as well. But to tie a bow on this, for me, as someone interested in the American West, cultural history, I think this whole thing has got a very strong Western flavor to it, although it's meant to be about works organized around the road. And I know one of the curator talked about this and said that this exhibit does this. To imagine yourself experiencing the Western United States from behind the windshield of a car is to come closer to understanding Ruscha's unusual vision of the world. And I think he does have an unusual vision. It's one that shows, I think, the ongoing importance of the West in the 20th century. I think it tells us through this imagery, if you want to use this imagery to get at that region's history, a longer, maybe grimmer, sort of humorous, and definitely more interesting story. So I'm happy to chat, take questions, or just hush and let you get on to enjoy a beautiful day outside. But I really appreciate you coming out today, and I appreciate the museum having me. So thank you all very much.